What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
20 years ago, I watched in horror holding my pregnant belly as Hurricane Katrina ripped through New Orleans, destroying everything in its path. But the hurricane would prove to be the easiest thing New Orleans, specifically the black people of New Orleans, would have to deal with. The days and weeks that followed were something out of a horror movie. Thousands packed inside of the dome, folks trapped on their roofs, people being shot by white vigilantes and the police, and the Bush administration demonstrating either complete incompetence to deal with the situation or, as many of us believe, complete disregard for black life. Kanye West said it best, and perhaps what should have signaled what was to come from the star, and that was George Bush don't care about black people. He paid a price for that statement, but it encapsulated what so many of us were feeling. America don't care about black people. Joining me to discuss, back to the show, is Adam Mahoney, climate and environment reporter at Capital B. He recently wrote an article that was published in Mother Jones. Is the legacy of Hurricane Katrina more lethal than the storm? Black New Orleans, you're going to help me with that, Adam. Navigate hopelessness, addiction, and the struggle to survive. That's why you're supposed to rehearse your script before you go live. How you doing?
I'm good. How you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Good to see your face after all this time. The listeners don't know yet, but we add in video to Law and Disorder, so you're one of our test cases. I wrote my intro before I read the title of your article, but that's exactly what I want to get in today, right? That the storm was horrific, but this country's response and the generational trauma that has followed has been catastrophic, right? And what we'll talk about a little bit is another hurricane could hit Katrina. I mean, could hit New Orleans at any moment, actually. So Hurricane Katrina made landfall and hit the U.S. Gulf Coast on Monday, August 29th, 2005. It made its primary landfall in southeastern Louisiana as a Category 3 hurricane, which in theory, the levees were built to sustain, right?
Exactly.
It killed, the numbers on Google is like almost 1,400 people, but I'm wondering if that perhaps is an undercount, and did billions of dollars in damage. Adam, can you help me understand a little bit about New Orleans, like geography and what parts of the city would hit the hardest and the demographics of those places?
Yeah, I mean, so pretty much all of New Orleans lies below sea level, which is why they have the levee protection system, the flood wall system that goes from Lake Pontchartrain, a major lake that's about 10 to 15 miles outside of the city, all the way along the Mississippi River, which cuts through New Orleans. And a lot of folks like to describe New Orleans as a bowl, so that the center of the city is the lowest point, and pretty much all around the landscape is water. You have, you know, the wetlands, the Mississippi River, Lake Pontchartrain, like I said, in the Gulf of Mexico is about 40 to 50 miles outside of the city. So if any kind of major storm comes through, it is going to flood. And really, if any, you know, rainstorm, not even a hurricane or a tropical storm happens, that the center of the city is going to see some flooding events. But when you have engineering failures like we saw during Katrina, and like we saw during Hurricane Betsy in 1965, and like some residents are afraid we might see if another hurricane happens, that's when you see that catastrophic kind of loss.
I'm pretty sure you weren't there because you're young. But you have spent, I mean, you and I have been talking about storms and impact on black people for a minute now. This is your area of expertise. I'd like to, if we can't, you let me know, but I'd like to walk through some of the horrors of the actual hurricane and then get into some of the 20 years of the aftermath, just to remember people about what that time, so I'm going to start with the Superdome, where thousands of folks were sheltered. For my listeners, I just did air quotes because shelter is not the word for what happened to folks. Can you talk about a bit how long people were there, what it was like to get food and water, the heat, absolute failure of that?
So before the storm actually hit, 2 days before Katrina hit, Ray Nagin, the mayor at the time, finally called for an evacuation of the city. But at that point, it was too late for a lot of folks, especially people, you know, low-income people who didn't have access to cars or maybe even just the financial capital to be like, I need to buy all of these things, find a way out the city and then go get a hotel somewhere. Like, that was just not feasible for a lot of folks in New Orleans. So starting the 27th is when we did start to see people evacuate towards the Superdome. And it was only supposed to, you know, folks were only supposed to be in there a day or two. But then once the levees failed, it created a chaos. But inside the Superdome, like you said, there were folks who did not have access to food, water, bathrooms. There were people, you know, urinating, defecating right next to their cots while they were sleeping on the floor. There were dead bodies, people, a lot of elderly folks who, you know, died either of heat exhaustion or just the trauma of the event. After hurricanes, because of the humidity, temperatures can rise very easily into 105, 110 with humidity for the days following a storm like that. So you can only imagine if you're trapped in a concrete building without food or water and it's 110 degrees, what that does to a body and what that does to a body in a city where a lot of folks had some, you know, debilitating illnesses associated with poverty when we think of like chronic illnesses and chronic disease. So yeah, I've talked to people in the aftermath who still remember seeing dead bodies next to them in the Superdome. They still remember seeing the National Guard with their long guns, seemingly pointing them at victims, at survivors, like they were a threat. And that trauma lives with people today.
I work with a playwright and an artist in the playwriting cohort that I'm in, and he's from New Orleans, and his family is from New Orleans, and he talks about the trauma of remembering dead bodies floating past people's, you know, doorsteps. We're going to get to the guns being pointed at people in a second, but I want to talk for a second about, and it's bizarre to me as I was preparing this interview to talk to you, and I'm going to talk to a brother named Roland Black, who you probably know. The images that are burned in my head, and I was just watching it on television, right? There's one of the father that was holding his lifeless child who didn't get the medication that the baby needed. The other horrors where people were stuck on their roofs. And people use it like, right? People don't want to get the gritty of that, but to your point, like bodily functions don't stop. The water is contaminated with all sorts of stuff. You really don't want it to touch you. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, so I've had the privilege over the last couple of years to get to know a gentleman named Mr. Robert Green, whose home, childhood home, the home he grew up in and the home he was in when the levees broke is two blocks from the site of the levee breach. And he was in his home with his mother, who was in her 70s, with his brother, who had a chronic illness, and with his three grandchildren who were all under the age of 12. And they did make it up to the roof. They had about 5 minutes after they first heard the levee break to when the waters came rushing in. They made it up to the roof, and their home was knocked off of its foundations, and it traveled two blocks before hitting a massive oak tree and splitting again. And that trauma, he lost his three-year-old granddaughter. She fell into the water. His mother passed away. And these are things that he still to this day every day is thinking about and living with. And he did vow to return. He rebuilt his home with the help of Brad Pitt's Make It Right Foundation, which now has been, there's a lot of issues with that, to say the least. Basically, just to explain it briefly, his foundation came in and offered to help finance homes, give people mortgages and loans to rebuild their homes. And he would connect them with a, you know, world-renowned architect. And the homes were actually not built to code. The vast majority of them, more than two-thirds of them, have either been demolished in the last 20 years or left abandoned. So Robert Green is living in one of those homes that is falling apart right now at the same site of you know, where he lost two of his loved ones. Yeah.
Which gets us to the generational trauma, but first, because there's more, black folks were murdered and or disabled for life, because particularly in Algiers, there was a roving band of white folks shooting at black folks. Some of whom were trying to get food and water to survive. That white people always call, looting, and also the New Orleans Police Department shot and killed people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, New Orleans is, and really any majority black city in this country, is kind of the perfect example of still what the racial divide looks like. So New Orleans at the time of Katrina was about 3/4 black. Now it's about 60% black. But the surrounding suburbs and towns right across the river are majority white, and it's all folks that left during white flight. And Algiers is one of those communities across the Mississippi River in the West Bank, in Algiers Point, where you have a majority white population that still to this day holds a lot of animosity towards what New Orleans is. And we saw that in full steam during the storm. And I think, I mean, we're still living in the aftermath of, to your point, the white vigilantes that were literally hunting down black folks, but also the major distrust with the New Orleans Police Department. There's been massive or numerous investigations that have come out in the aftermath. There's been recordings that have been leaked where basically NLPD was giving the directive to shoot anybody under any circumstances. And we did see in the 2 weeks after the storm, five people get killed by NOPD, more than a dozen people got shot by NOPD, and massive cover-ups where the police department lied about, receiving gunfire at their end when nobody was actually shooting at them. And to this day, the police department is still under a consent decree, 20 years later because of their actions.
And as I know in Oakland, because we too have a 20-plus-year-old consent decree, you only on consent decree for almost 2 decades or over 2 decades because you can't get your ish together, that you continue to brutalize community or violate the agreements of the consent decree. I'm clocking time, and I want to get to. So the article that you wrote, "As the Legacy of Hurricane Katrina More Lethal Than the Storm," really looks at 20 years later the trauma that still exists, the impact that all of this had and continues to have. So I want to talk about gentrification and displacement, right? So disaster capitalism is when corporate, this is my definition. I'm sure there's a fancier one somewhere online. I know Naomi Klein talks about it better than I do in her book, but it's when like corporations, countries even, right? Because the United States does this a lot. Like if there's another country that has a disaster, we fly in, promise to rebuild them, and then we own them for the, for, forever. But exploit the conditions that natural disasters create, right? So in New Orleans, right? So everything's devastated. There's got to be rebuilding. Who shows up? What happens? And what is the impact on black folks?
Yeah, I mean, I will say it's a mix of. We did see tens of thousands of folks move into the city, mainly white, middle class and above, quote unquote, Good Samaritans come in to help rebuild the city on top of millions of dollars of nonprofit dollars coming into the city in an attempt to rebuild parts of New Orleans. But what we've seen in the aftermath, it's not rebuilt for the folks that called those neighborhoods home for generations. So, I mean, just looking at like the Upper Ninth Ward and the Lower Ninth Ward, where those are really the communities that were kind of the poster child for the destruction and devastation of the storm. To this day, if you went down the Lower Ninth Ward, a block that at one point had 12 homes on it would probably have two or three now. But as we've seen that devastation and kind of that erasure of folks, the black population in the Lower Ninth Ward has dropped by 67%. So they have 2/3 less amount of black people in that neighborhood as they did in 2000. But the white population has grown by 70%. So we've seen folks who have, it doesn't even mean you have to be wealthy or rich, but if you have any kind of stability or financial capital to be able to move into New Orleans and to buy a property, because compared to maybe your coastal cities, you can get a home still to this day in New Orleans, a 3-bedroom home for $200,000, which you can't do in California or in the Northeast. Can't even dream about doing that. But at the same time, with that change in population, we've also seen a change in like not only the culture of the city, but the resources and how they're shared throughout the city. So New Orleans is the only school district in the entire country that is all private. It is a charter school system, and we know what that means for Black and low-income children and their access to education. Studies have proven that time and time again that those resources are not allocated equally. So you've had the loss of education, you've had the loss of cultural institutions. The economy has completely shifted. Nearly half of the city's economy now is tourism. So you're working low-wage service jobs. That's really kind of your only option if you are from the city. If you don't leave and attempt to go to college somewhere else and probably don't come back. So all of those factors on top of, you know, the major public health, our hospital was closed, mental health resources were gutted. So kind of pretty much every facet of life has seen an attack in the aftermath of New Orleans, or the aftermath of Katrina, in a way that you can really only access those resources if you have the financial capital, and it's in a city that is majority Black and where nearly half of the Black residents in the city live in poverty. Now that just is untenable.
Adam Mahoney, what kind of impact does the anniversary annually have on particularly the Black residents of New Orleans? What's the total tenor?
Yeah, I mean, for most people so I grew up in Los Angeles. I was not there during Katrina, but for most people that I've talked to, you know, this anniversary and last anniversary, a lot of people don't like to think about it or don't attempt to think about it because of the massive amount of grief that washes over them. I went to a block party actually the day after the anniversary this year, and then on the day of the anniversary, there was an event at the Levees. And a lot of people do attempt to try to find the joy and still being able to call this place home, because they know a lot of folks have left or been pushed out or lost their lives. But ultimately, it does lead to an increase in kind of poor mental health outcomes, which we outline in that article. You know, therapists told me that in the aftermath, they do see an uptick of folks at least attempting to get mental health care, which is a good thing. But the fact that, you know, people feel that they need it so much is really where the devastation comes from.
I'm going to read a short paragraph from your article, Adam. As the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina approached in 2015, Michelle McCollum, a 25-year-old mother of two, drove her children, ages 3 and 5, to a once bustling but now desolate industrial area of New Orleans. It was there that police say she shot her two young children and then herself. This is an example of a phenomenon that you talk about in the article called Depths of Despair. What is Depths of Despair, and what are the ways it manifests?
So depths of despair really relate to any deaths related to helplessness and poverty. It's a term researchers coined in the early 2000s to look at kind of the intersection of, you know, mental health traumas, addiction, and deaths related to poverty. So that really looks like chronic illnesses. And Louisiana, 20 years after Katrina, is the state that is most vulnerable. Our residents in Louisiana is most vulnerable to die a death of despair. And a lot of that has to do with the trauma of Katrina, but also all of those different factors that I listed, where, yes, if you don't have access to resources, access to the things that you need to survive, that is where that helplessness creeps up. And, you know, in New Orleans, in the aftermath of Katrina, there was a massive uptick in cases of depression, PTSD, and also deaths by suicide. And still to this day, the city has higher rates of addiction and deaths by suicide than the national average. And yeah, those are things, once again, where the storm's kind of, the aftermath is still lingering throughout the city and kind of inescapable for a lot of folks.
I don't think you said this part of it, but if you did, it's worth repeating that when the professional people came up with Depths of Despair, just white folks were the majority of people impacted by this phenomenon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Up until the mid 2010s, white folks did die at a much higher rate for these depths of despair. But in the last decade, Black people specifically, middle-aged and above, have actually died at a much higher rate. And a lot of that has to do with, we do think about who is experiencing extreme poverty, who's experiencing homelessness in this country. It's Black folks 40 and above are the vast majority of those folks who are, you know, dealing with those issues. And that's true in Louisiana, that is true in California and across the country. And that shift has really contributed to the larger shift in who is dying from these kind of deaths.
Talk to us about the ways in which Black folks in New Orleans are trying to heal, that the Black therapists that are left there, that a lot of them left, a lot of therapists, period, left. But the black therapists, psychologists, folks, you know, that are there, what are they trying to do to help community heal?
Yeah, there are organizations that are hosting, you know, free group therapy sessions once a month, kind of call-in spaces where people can just show up when they want to get services that they need to talk to someone. And I think one of the really kind of beautiful things that a lot of natives are doing now is really tapping back into the culture of like art, which is obviously art and music is inseparable from when you think of New Orleans. But in a lot of ways, in the immediate aftermath of the storm, the folks that were able to jump back into performing were not the long time generational Black performers. It was either, you know, white newcomers or white musicians that had been in the city, but there's a lot of programs now, youth programs in particular, where folks are getting trained in the arts, which has been a beautiful thing to see, but also can kind of point to a shift in the ways that we address issues of mental health. It doesn't always have to be clinical, especially when we think about, you know, the Black community, who statistically is less likely to trust or want to use mental health services. There's a way to build community camaraderie and companionship outside of kind of the institutional forces.
There was something, Adam, in your article that, you know, smacked me in the face, and I don't know. That a lot of the services that folks are getting through these through these folks that are trying to deal with the PTSD and the trauma are paid for by Medicaid.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, Louisiana is one of the highest states or one of the highest rates of usage of Medicaid for residents. And yes, when you think about Trump's budget and the attacks on Medicaid and health care, that will have detrimental effects and impact on a place like Louisiana, where you still have a lot of rural populations across the state. And then in our urban cores, have some of the highest poverty rates in the country. So that's another factor. And I would also just push the fact that at the same time, when we think about maybe the disaster of Katrina and climate change, the Trump administration is, you know, trying to gut FEMA, trying to reverse environmental protections, make it easier for the hundreds of petrochemical plants that line the Mississippi River to pollute more, to dump more chemicals into the air and water, that then in turn has adverse effects on Black folks all across the state.
Well, I'll be continuing to track, and Adam, you will definitely be asked to come back on the show. Thank you so much for your work and being willing to speak to me again and again. Have a good day. Thank you.
You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.